He's, each suit that he has is like, it's like $250,000. There's like 20 of these suits, and they're set up to be sewn perfectly for him to be exact size. So you have to call, like, I think this much weight's going to come off in the cut. Like here, I think we're going to gain this much weight. Oh shit, the legs are too big, or like whatever. And you have to really modify everything along the way. So I think it led to us being hyper specific about our practice, knowing exactly what we're talking about, and also being like, I don't know, being able to admit it. That practice led to a lot. The precision in it, I think, is probably why I'm interested in jiu-jitsu. And the fact that you took like 3 days to teach a mounted arm bar was like, this is exactly what I love about jiu-jitsu, is that it's like a lot of people come in, they teach, and that's the technique, and they just wait for the person to pick up the details. But people, I think that's why they try to get into jiu-jitsu, because they don't know how to learn details. They don't know how to recognize, you know, when you described mount as like low mount, medium mount, high mount, people have described it, not the first, but you could tell that there was in your head when you're moving, you have kind of like a subconscious recognition of the detail that you're into. And that really resonated. So I don't know what we want to talk about. Our format is that we're not super interview style.
It's just a chat.
And we can talk about kind of whatever you want. If anything is kind of off and you're like, that didn't sound right, I can cut it. It's not a big deal. We can pull the whole episode. You won't hurt my feelings. If the sound is shit, won't hurt my feelings. Like,
no, man, let's do it.
We want a good product, and we want to represent you how you want to be represented. That's cool, my bottom line. Brother. Cool. We're going.
Sweet.
So, Daniel Strauss, also known as the Raspberry Ape. Welcome to the Dice. Well, we used to be called the Dissect Podcast. We're now the nonprofit podcast. We haven't been the Dissect Podcast for 5 years, but I still fucking say it, and that drives me crazy. But on that note, I want to start somewhere kind of out of left field. What did you eat for breakfast?
Wow. I mean, I can remember because it was about 2.5 minutes ago, but we have an incredible spread here, and it was the most incredible spread of cured meats. So it was cured meats and cheese and some yogurt and honey.
Nice.
It's great.
It feels very Eastern European to me. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it does actually. Yeah.
It's an Eastern Bloc kind of feel, at least for breakfast for me.
Yeah, a bit Italian as well. They like the meats.
Do you get much into nutrition in your training, or are you fairly meat and potatoes kind of guy?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty strict. Not strict. It depends on kind of, it's a relative term. But, you know, I put a lot of intention into my food. Yeah. Very, very simple principle of the least amount of processing as possible. I do a lot of cooking. I've been meal prepping for the first time. This year, started in the beginning of the year, and it's been completely game changing in terms of being able to adjust my nutrition for what I want to achieve and not having to spend loads of time every day cooking.
Yeah. I do like the cooking process, but I think you've nailed like the concepts that we try to hit on probably more than anything, which is like, how manufactured is your food, or really like how in control of it are you? Yeah. And when you're eating out or all that stuff, so you have to prepare it yourself, and that usually gives people a headache. Our take on nutrition in a nutshell is kind of funny, because we're just like, I think people get it wrong. I think people are like, calories, macros, which we did for years, so don't get like, this is my own recognition, and then they're like micronutrients. They talk about all of this stuff that you can't touch. You can't see. You can, but you know, you get an eyeball for macronutrient profile or whatever. But when it comes down to it, I think nutrition, if you don't know how to make food taste good, you're not going to do nutrition. You're not going to do it. So it's about taking the things that taste good to you and then modifying them so that they work, like in the most natural form possible. Mostly I just start with like a random question just so it opens up. But if you had to describe yourself, like, how would you introduce yourself? Because I don't want to do it injustice.
Okay, good question. I would describe myself as a problem solver.
Ah, fuck.
it's the thing that always attracted me in the jiu-jitsu, to be honest, is that I remember as a kid, I'd always love a problem, something that was practical, not maths problems, but practical problems. We need to do this, we need to do this. I drop my phone down the side of here and I can't reach it. I'm like, okay, bring me a broom handle, some duct tape and a coat hanger and you know, try and find a way to get around it. And I've always enjoyed that. And I think jiu-jitsu, the beauty of jiu-jitsu is that you get to do that every single time you roll. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be different every single time. And you can do that for the 20, 30 years and you're always going to find new problems every day.
That, I would argue, just as a side point, when you're finding a stick and taping it, you are doing math.
Yeah, no, you are doing math. I'm saying I like the applied, the applied math.
And, applied math, I think is probably the that's kind of funny because we usually say that if we were anything, it's hard to describe. You're like, I'm a trainer. That means I dangle a piece of candy over somebody while they like do jumping jacks or whatever. I'm a coach. It just means I whisper in their ear what to do right before the big moment. And it's like, none of that ever really made sense. Sometimes I explain what we do is teach people, but really I think we're just problem solving. You could really give, and jiu-jitsu is a great metaphor for that, I think. In your experience with jiu-jitsu, what brought it to, or what brought you to it, or it goes the other way sometimes?
What brought it to me? It was an accident, a very happy accident. And I was training martial arts in my sort of early teens, doing different things, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, a couple of weeks of judo, a couple of days of kung fu and this and that. And then I joined a Japanese jiu-jitsu, a traditional jiu-jitsu gym. I was training there for a few months. And then one day, one of the instructors left, another instructor who was already doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu at the time took over. And we basically turned it into a Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym. So I technically never joined a jiu-jitsu club.
I joined a
Japanese jiu-jitsu club that became a Brazilian jiu-jitsu club.
Do you think that really like that influenced how you saw jiu-jitsu from the very beginning?
No.
Okay.
Because the Japanese jiu-jitsu stuff wasn't resonating with me. Dotted around a lot of martial arts and nothing really grabbed my attention. And then when it changed and we were doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, the grappling, the super practical, is no longer like block, 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 throw. That's kind of all hypothetical and theoretical stuff. But as soon as we started grappling, it grabbed me and I kind of fell in love with it from there.
I think, and now there's this like, maybe I feel it because we're in America, there's this big like kind of, I would call it esoteric, but it's territorial. It's like, who created it? What did it? Like, is it Brazilian? Is it Japanese? Is it American jiu-jitsu? And all of that is irrelevant to me because it's like this, that's what makes it what it is. It's this refinement on an original concept. But I've always wondered if people started in a more traditional Japanese style, if that like, if that is what kind of anchors them to the idea of that, no, this is the traditional method. That being said, you have a very untraditional approach to jiu-jitsu, especially in how you teach. What was that developed from?
In terms of like comparing jiu-jitsu to other art forms and more traditional things, for me personally, I almost feel like grappling exists within humans and we just discover it and then give it names. So for me, grappling is jiu-jitsu and sambo and wrestling and, you know, every single thing that we've ever wrestled or two kids rolling around the floor with each other. It might not be, you know, when we give it names like Brazilian jiu-jitsu, that is just one interpretation of it. But two kids rolling around the floor wrestling as kids is they're grappling. And that's basically what I do. You know, it's sort of all encompassing that sort of thing. In terms of the teaching, I'm in a fortunate position I'm in a position where I've been teaching for a really long time. So I've been teaching since I was 16 years old, which back in the UK when I was 16 years ago, there was not a lot of high level guys. There weren't a lot of high level instructors. So I was in a position where a 16-year-old blue belt could run a class.
Yeah.
And that is not something that you're going to see happen today. And an adult's class, not a kid's class, adult's class. And I've basically been teaching ever since. So I've had a long time to develop my teaching methods and sort of work and kind of just always having a, always doing anything with an open mind and trying to adjust and always improve stuff. You know, like my teaching, you think having taught for, and obviously there's people who've taught longer than me, but having taught for 16 years, you'd expect after the first 5-10 years that I'd settle into a style of teaching. But I am changing things that I've been teaching for years, even as recent as a few weeks ago. So for example, I'll give you a really good example. I'm sort of most known for my guillotine stuff.
Yeah.
And I keep trying to tell people that I know other jiu-jitsu apart from guillotines. But I'm known for my guillotine stuff, and it's the seminar that I've done the most. I do a lot of seminars. So I've done my guillotine seminar just under 150 times. And it's basically the way that I like to do seminars is, you know, have something that I'm trying to convey, and then really put a lot of thought into finding the best method of teaching that and expressing that. Like, it's not for me, I think for a lot of people, jiu-jitsu seminars is about showing off how cool your techniques are. For me, it's not about that. It's about how can I pass this information on in a way that is actually able for the student to be able to use that and remember it. It's almost like with tattoos. Some people will tattoo in a way where it looks good straight away, but it's not going to look good in 5 years. Yeah. I want to make it sure that it's going in there and it's going to look good in 20 years' time. So that's sort of what I'm thinking, and that's what I'd done. I taught, you know, like 147 guillotine seminars that were basically identical, and then last weekend, for the first time ever, I changed the order in which I was doing stuff because I thought that it would be better than how I'd been teaching it. And then from now on, that's the way I'm going to do it. So I'm always looking to adjust and change and try and use the feedback, you know, work out what's going there and even trialing it sometimes and teaching it one way there and teaching it one way somewhere else. And yeah, you're always developing.
There are a couple of things that go back to your first statement, but like this idea behind discovering versus inventing. This is like a very like theoretical mathematician conversation in some cases. Discoveries, most mathematicians would say that they're not obviously inventing equations, that they're just, the universe is like revealing them. Yeah, it's like, oh, this just existed, I found it. And I think that is such a bigger way to look. Everything just exists, right? The best musicians say the same thing about their music. It was already in the ether.
The muse delivered it.
I practiced hard enough that I could hear it, and then I could orchestrate it in a way that did justice to it. And I think that is, maybe some of it's like false humility or like fake humility. But I think when you really do believe that, all of this stuff just exists, you're just kind of like peeking around the universe.
You're just a vessel to sort of digest
the
collective unconsciousness.
I'm the conduit.
I
like that approach because I think it matches traditionally with what I know about the Roman Greco tradition of wrestling, where they used the physical exertion, and this is, you know, obviously comes back to our style of training, which is like, it's just a medium for you to have an experience that changes you internally, and that change internally will be reflected externally if it holds, kind of like what you're saying. If it's a deep tattoo that is done in a way that is principally based, conceptually crafted, then the changes that I make mentally, spiritually, if you want to get there, they have to be reflected in your practice. And I think in fitness, you see it all the time. A bunch of people, hey, you got to do this, and then their body falls apart, or they're not actually paying attention to what they're doing. They're just, they temporarily look good and they get the attention, but all of those principles don't hold up over time.
Yeah.
And I think the Greeks probably had it right, where they used this exchange of energy between two very, you know, capable human beings in order to sit down later and then talk about what that meant. So the gymnasium led to, you know, apparently quite a bit of philosophy, stoicism. And I think when I look at jiu-jitsu, it tends to breed all the qualities inherent in Zen and in stoicism, two totally different schools, but they kind of came to the same conclusion. And that maps onto what you're saying about the uncovering what already exists, like the feature of whatever the tenet you want to, maybe in Stoicism, it's the ability to control or the ability to at least control your reaction to something is very reflective of jujitsu. Mm. When somebody, you know, you for example, smashes your chest in a certain way on my face, I laugh because it's so fucking terrible. Mm. But instead, maybe I've just conditioned myself to laugh instead of getting angry. My emotional response is just geared towards something that's more playful, mm. because that if I went the other way, I wouldn't laugh. There's no longevity in it. If I'm like emotional or angry or spiteful about somebody applying pressure to me in a very clever way. But so instead I laugh. And I think a lot of people, when I roll with them, I'm usually laughing because they're like better than me, or they're doing something that I didn't see coming. And that is kind of a joke to me. It's like, it reveals like the humor of it. To come back to kind of like the philosophical thing, has this, obviously, you know a lot about that. I see it in your training. You do grab onto a lot of concepts that are high out there, and you have a very good way of giving to people how they can digest them. But that was obvious to me in your class. It's one of the reasons why I want to talk to you. What philosophically holds you to this practice, if there is, or is it kind of happenstance that you just practice in a way that reflects all of these?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the discussion, you'll get me excited whenever you start talking about ancient Greece, because I'm a huge fan of the culture and stuff. And yeah, you're right, there's a huge time between grappling, wrestling, and philosophy. I was in Athens last year, actually, and I went to the, I think it was the Museum of Archaeology in Athens, and they have, it's a super, super famous image of two wrestlers. And it's on a Kyrenos, I think it is. It's like a funeral box, like a that would go on above a grave, and yeah, it's a picture of wrestlers, and we use this image all the time, and it was like kind of weird. I've seen this image plastered all over the place through, you know, memes and jiu-jitsu pages, and then I'm seeing the original marble creation, and it does make you think, well, there's really this deep link from going back to ancient Greek culture, which is like the basis of culture and philosophy in the West, and how deeply tied in it is. You know, like you said, Socrates's academy was a school for philosophy and a wrestling gym as well. And this idea, and Plato was a wrestler, and, you know, Plato means broad. It was like his wrestling nickname. And we kind of lose a little bit of that. This idea, I think, in modern times where you're either a meathead or you're a nerd, and you kind of can't be both. And I'm like, if you're
egghead. Egghead, meathead.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, there's a load of great badass quotes about, you know, I'd rather be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war,
or
all of that stuff. And so, yeah, it certainly is something that I'm always thinking about. But, you know, I couldn't tell you X, Y, Z philosophy that I follow in my training. But I think, like, for me, philosophy is just about awareness of psychology and who we are as humans, and you can like use that lens to look at everything. And for me, for like jiu-jitsu and how I teach, I'm just always trying to never ever rest on my laurels in terms of how I'm doing something, and just always be open and aware and happy to change and happy to admit that I was wrong. Like, a big thing about the mount that I was teaching is like, I've taught mount what I believe now, what I consider now to be wrong, sort of almost like you know, I'm back in a time machine, and I'm watching myself teach mount, and I'm banging on the window. I'm going, no, don't do that. And a lot of people, they might never be open-minded enough to go, oh, I've been doing this wrong. I don't want to do anything else. And that's going to hold them back a lot. So just I'm willing to admit that I'm wrong a lot. And it allows me to then develop stuff that, otherwise I wouldn't be able to.
That's an extremely rare quality. Is there something that pointed you to that early on, a mentor, a teacher, something that like alluded to the benefit and the value of being able to see clearly, or be honest about what you are in the world? Or is that just a gift that you've managed to hone?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. What I think it really comes down to is, like, admitting you're wrong comes down to an ego thing. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like as I've got older, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe when I was in my early 20s, maybe I wouldn't have admitted so much. But I feel like as I've got a little bit older, I kind of, the ego's gone a little bit. And I put that down to I'm very... at this point in my life, very comfortable with who I am, and I don't feel like I have anything to prove to anyone, which means that I can be really critical of myself right now. I can be critical of stuff that I've done in the past. And if you go, I'm not afraid of being wrong. I'm not afraid of being an idiot or admitting that I was an idiot in this regard or that regard, as long as I'm able to. I mean, really, like, you're only an idiot if you realize you've done something wrong and you continue to do it. That's the only thing. You can't blame someone really for being wrong.
Right.
But when they're wrong, they realize they're wrong and they keep on refusing to accept any difference, then okay, he's
an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. A big thing, probably I would say one of the tenets that maybe jiu-jitsu is so good at clarifying is, like, you can't really lie in it. Right, like it is, and maybe this is what led to the origination or the idea, the concept that gymnasia led to symposia, or, you know, the talking that happened after could only happen after you recognized what was happening in reality. And that's the thing for us is, in fitness, it's like, it's a truth serum. Like, you're only able to do it when you're honest about how you're doing it. You can't really mask anything. In real fitness, I'm not talking about, like, showing off your abs. You can lie about that all day or put a filter on or whatever the thing is. But the expression of one of these energy systems, strength, capacity, endurance, like, when you're either going the fastest or you're not, you're either going the longest or you're not, you're either lifting the most weight or you're not. And so, in that inherent practice, that physical practice that kind of roots us, you are what you are. And if you want to get better, you have to be able to recognize, like, why you're not getting better. And I think a lot of people, you don't get me wrong, because the majority of people can and will find a way to lie to themselves about something. You know, the first starts in jiu-jitsu, it's always, you know, the rule set or the, this was wrong. They set the conditions for the excuses first. But really, when you look at it, there's only way to improve is to look at why something doesn't work and then to try to fix it. And I think that is such a noble quality about what jiu-jitsu sets the terms for, maybe how you could figure that out. Fitness sets the terms how you could figure that out, but people still rarely do. And for us, in order to keep that reality real, I guess is the best way to put it, we have to kind of curate our environment. Do you notice, and you mentioned this either, you don't actually teach at a school. You only do...
At the moment, yeah. I taught at a school for 12 years, and then I left just before COVID to do a bit of traveling and training and competing and around the world. And then COVID happened. I couldn't do any of that.
So. Gotcha. Okay. So it's just happenstance.
But I'm in the it's not out of choice. Yeah. I've been looking to open a gym for a couple of years now, but it's just difficult finding somewhere.
Oh, for sure.
I want to teach.
Okay. And in that desire to fulfill probably the thing that you're best at, you know, what are you looking to set as an environment that is different than what you see that's out there?
Yeah. I mean, do you know what? I'll answer that question if I remember to, but sure. I want to kind of just that you about jiu-jitsu being truth, and it is, and it's one of the beautiful things about it. You cannot lie on the mats, because it's either happening or it's not happening. But then, and because we're talking a lot about teaching as well, teaching jiu-jitsu and doing jiu-jitsu are two very different things. And people really do kind of push them together, and they just, you know, people who are great grapplers aren't necessarily good teachers. People who are good teachers aren't necessarily good grapplers. And because I've been teaching basically as long as I've been doing jiu-jitsu, you know, I've been doing jiu-jitsu for 18 years. I've been teaching for 16 years. At this point, it's kind of negligible first couple of years. So I've always walked through jiu-jitsu always thinking about how I'm teaching stuff. And I think it's something that I do naturally, which is, I mean, you asked me earlier what I kind of define myself or how I describe myself as a problem solver, and essentially that's what I am. But if you ask me to describe what I do with my time and with my life, it's communicate. because I teach, I commentate, and I do podcasts are the kind of three main things that I do, and they're all communication. So I think inherently what I am is problem solver, communicator, and the stuff I communicate is grappling and some strength stuff. And because I've always, and maybe it's a, maybe that's created from having been an instructor from such a young age, or maybe that was just something that I would always be doing, and I just happened to find jiu-jitsu and start teaching it. But I look at jiu-jitsu through two very different lenses, and I'm very aware of the fact that I'm looking at two different lenses. So when I'm rolling, and it's a funny thing, I was having a discussion about someone recently, and a lot of people say when they roll, it's meditation. Their mind is empty, and they're focused in on the moment. When I roll, my mind is more active than it is at any other part time of the day. I feel more creative. I feel more enlightened. I have more epiphanies about jiu-jitsu often, and sometimes not, but normally about jiu-jitsu. And I'm, you know, especially recently, I've gotten to the habit of, in between rounds, running to my phone, taking notes on something that I've worked out, because you forget it otherwise the next round and someone's choking you and you
forgot. Muse.
Yeah, that's the muse, exactly. And it comes to me whilst I'm rolling. And I'm very aware that it comes with very two different voices. One is talking to me as an athlete, competitor, grappler, and the other one's talking to me as an instructor purely. And so sometimes I'll be doing something, and the difference really is the difference between having an idea about how you can do something and having an idea about how you can explain something. And I receive those two things in very different ways. Mm-hmm. I can almost go to the list of, okay, things to do and then ways to teach it. You know, I'm doing something, I think, I've been teaching this. I'm like, no. I should actually be teaching people how to do this. So I've always, or certainly more recently, but I believe I've always had those two very different sides of it. And a lot of people just merge them together. So going back to the truth thing, the doing jiu-jitsu is truth. The teaching jiu-jitsu isn't. And that's the problem. There's a big disconnect between the two. This idea, and I think it was a Malcolm Gladwell book. I'm not 100% sure, but because it was a while ago that I read it, but this book about, they had some tennis players. They asked them, you know, how do you get topspin on a ball? Oh, yeah. And they say, as you hit it, you turn your wrist face down and it puts topspin on the ball. And they throw motion capture dots all over them, and they have them hit a ball a few times, and they have a look and they analyze it, and none of them are turning their wrist. And they ask them again, how do you put topspin on a ball? And they go, you turn your wrist down. You go, but you're not doing that. And there's this real disconnect in all sports between how you're taught things and how you do things. Mm-hmm. Because when you do something for long enough, and that's the beauty of the sparring, that's why martial arts without a sparring component just don't work.
Stands.
Because where you really, it's just make-believe. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't exist really in reality. It's the doing the thing and the reacting to the thing where you're really developing, because you have that immediate cause and effect. You work out what's working, you make adjustments. That didn't work, this worked. We do it again, it works again. Okay, that's how we do it. So you're seeing people go, so that's how people do things, but how people teach things generally is just how they were taught things.
Justification.
Okay, yeah. So I'm taught how to do an armbar from God in this way. I teach my student how to do an armbar from God this way. He teaches his student how to do an armbar from God this way. When I do an armbar from God, it doesn't look like that. So you see me armbar from someone from God, and they go, how'd you do armbar from God? And I show the way I was taught, not the way I do it. Yeah. There's this real disconnect. And I use the example of armbar from God because it's the best example. Because almost everyone I've seen teaches armbar from God the same way. And it is in a way that does not work on the mats. Yeah. You know, wrist, foot on the hip, cut the angle, throw the leg over. It never happens. Okay. So which is fine to teach. I'll still teach it that way. But with the explanation that this is not going to work when you spar. I'm teaching you this because you've been training for a week, and I want to teach you concepts like bringing the arm across the center line of the body. I want to teach you concepts like turning the hip to 90 degrees. I want you to see what the finished position of an armbar looks like. And this is the easiest way to do that. But this isn't going to work when you spar. Once you've done this a little bit and you're really comfortable with these ideas, here's a way that actually works, you know? Yeah. And it's being aware enough to filter through the information you're being given and working out what actually works. So that there is always truth in the application, but there's often mistakes. Right. When I say the opposite of truth isn't necessarily a lie, it could just be wrong. Right.
Yeah.
And it can be an honest mistake for a lot of people, which is what it is. But there can be a real disconnect between those two things. So jiu-jitsu, in the whole umbrella of it, doing and teaching, there is sometimes a lot of errors and mistakes. And that's something that I'm always thinking about.
That's you gave me a lot to ping off, so I gotta
listen. Yeah, that's all right. Sir.
No. Because I think you hit fundamentally a couple things. The topspin on a tennis ball is a great example of it, because I think are you familiar with Greg Sauter's? Greg Sauter.
Yes.
Okay, so he's like, what he's brought over was Dr. Gray's ecological model.
How we move.
And that comes from the original study. Can't remember the original, but in 1920s, they were looking at blacksmiths, right? And they postulated, kind of like hypothesized, I guess, since if it's a scientific study or whatever, that the best blacksmiths, and you would love this because we'll get into the grip stuff, but how the best blacksmiths had the most repeatability.
Yes.
And so they assigned the same thing, kind of like mocap suit, but like, you know, 1920s version of it. So it's probably like light bulbs and copper pipes or something. I don't know how they actually did it, but they're watching and they're basically tracking. And what they see is actually the opposite of what they hypothesized, that the worst blacksmiths with the worst outcomes, maybe subjective, maybe not, because you're dealing with metal or whatever, but they had the same hit every time, and the best blacksmiths had the most variation in their hit, but to the same end point. So they were making micro adjustments,
which makes sense. Of course,
because
the better you are at doing something, the more you're able to make these tiny changes. The exact same position is going to feel, I do the mount on you that I taught yesterday, and someone that I've just taught does the mount on you, even though we are doing the exact same thing with the exact same goal in mind, mine's going to feel different because the unexplainable, unknowable repetitions that I've done over a long time when I'm sparring, I'm not developed that from doing practicing technique, but when I'm sparring, I know all of these tiny micro adjustments and I can adapt to your body.
And this is kind of the interesting thing. When you do separate the thing that you do from the thing you teach, you learn very quickly that a lot of the times you just justify what you're doing, because there's a lot of unconscious ability there.
Yeah.
Right? You've probably done things so much that your body understands it to a degree where it's making micro adjustments that your conscious awareness is not able to pick up necessarily. And it's a feeling thing. And this is, I have this theory. So I had a friend of mine. So we teach something called symposium. And what it is we don't teach, we don't tell people what we're going to teach. They come there and we teach them how to learn it, if that makes sense. It's kind of like an abstract thing. But when you get there, we basically ask a bunch of questions and get to the bottom of what the real problem is. And then we work at ways to like uncover it. It's more of like a, you know, a meta learning camp, if you would. And it is fitness based. And so it works that way. But the idea, accidentally, we pulled that name. Accidentally. And a lot of people don't know that we are not that smart, where we figured out that it was only a synonym to seminar, because I hate seminars, right? You show up, they have their thing, and you're like, I'm going to teach this, this, and this, and this. And then, I don't know, maybe you want to learn the subject so it makes sense. Yeah. But in reality, people don't really learn that way. And this is what Dr. Gray's work kind of comes onto. And later, I forgot his name, but the book is Teaching a Subversive Activity, which kind of changed my whole aspect of how I taught, because you really have to ask questions before you know what somebody wants to learn or how they're going to learn it. Anyway, on the subject of like the teaching and the truth seeking thing, I think is phenomenally dead on. And you're working at something that I think the entire fitness, anything that's physically taught needs to kind of conceptually remodel what they're looking at. Because you're right, there is a utility in kind of going through the ranges of motion that show you a deeper concept, but it's not necessarily true. I saw it in Olympic style weightlifting for years, because
everybody's arguing about the catapult method and what happens with the heel and what happens with the hip and whether you should start from the bottom or the top and work backwards or vice versa. And in order to get down to like, well, can they lift the weight or not? And you're like, and what are the best weightlifters doing? And the truth is the best weightlifters are doing different things, right? There is not the objective with the vast amount of variability that goes into the body types and the weights and the kind of things that they're doing, that is what decides what they should do. Mm-hmm. You know, your fulcrums and levers decide your technique for you. You can try to copy the best, but it's really not a good place to start, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe it is a good place to start. Emulation is probably, if I see you rest, I'm like, fuck, he has a good style. Mm. You know, I really like how dominant you are. I really like, maybe I just like how apparently simple. And I don't like when people say this about people's jiu-jitsu games, because usually if they have like one trick or something, they're like, oh, it's just simple. They just guillotine or they just mount, you know, Hodge choke from the mount or whatever. And you're like, no, but to be able to do that on the most diverse players mean that they have the most complex game, because exactly. They're rerouting everybody back down to a single point, which is the hardest thing to do, right? That is the most strategic, mind-blowing thing that you could ever do. If you were going to write a book on it, it would be called The Art of War, because that's essentially what, you know, I want the outcome that I want. Here's all the ways to do it. And it's just to win, I just need to, you know, funnel it. So that is a fascinating thing that you're onto. I'm glad that you know Dr. Gray's work too, because I mentioned it the other day, I think when you said something.
You said it.
Yeah, and I was like, oh yeah. Because of how you, I think it's how you very, I appreciated how you started the class, which is before I tell you how to do something, see what you do.
Yeah.
And I think what you're looking for immediately resonated, because you want us to feel before we receive something, you know, have some kind of concept before you mess it up with ideas.
Exactly.
Which, how, where did you discover that?
Do you know what it was? It was, the ecological dynamic stuff that is like super, super popular right now. And I think it's going to start to get more popular. Mm. And you never know. I mean, I think that there's, the ideas that ecological dynamics is kind of talking about are true and they work. I think you can go too far in the other direction. Again, when you make any one ideology or methodology sort of religion to you, and you can go too far in the other direction, this idea that, you know, we should never show anyone anything and only create, you know, facilitate sparring scenarios and games that are going to teach them that. I'm like, no one's accidentally going to come up with an omoplata or something like that, probably. So I think there's a combination of, you've got a spectrum of, you show nothing. And, you know, you put two people in a room, you tell them to grapple for a thousand years and how good's their technique, who knows? Or you show everything. You know, and I think the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle. And I've always taught from a concept based approach, but perhaps not as, even though I speak about the concepts, and here's a big thing, there's a big difference between talking about concepts and applying those concepts. So I could tell, so for example, we're talking about the mount stuff to give a bit more context to the listeners. So, you know, I wanted to teach mount. The first class that I did, the whole idea of the first class was this thing that I've only discovered really recently whilst being really immersed. I've like been super immersed in mount position for the last year. And it's about, this concept is about controlling the direction of the head. Because when people try and escape the mount position, they're going to turn towards the left or to the right. And if they turn towards the right, you turn their head to the left and it kills what their body's doing in that direction and vice versa. It's super simple stuff. And if I sit everyone down and I say, and I explain that, and then I say, here are the ways to do it. We can use the head, we can use the elbow, we can use the forearm, we can do all of this stuff. And this is going to be the result. Even though I'm going to let them still do the drill, they are trying to do what I've told them to do. It's coming 100% externally. Yeah. And because it's becoming 100% externally, they're only trying to, it's like looking over at someone else's homework and trying to write it down. You're not going to get good at that subject. Yeah. You're not thinking, it's not coming from inside. So then I did the, sort of, as I developed the way that I taught the seminar, that first seminar, it was originally, you start with, you tell them the concept, you show them the concept, they practice it. Mm. Then it's, you tell them the concept, but not how. they practice it, and then you show them some ideas how to do it. Mm. And then you go a step further back, which is you tell them nothing, you show them nothing. They try to do just hold the mount position, see what they do. So it's kind of, this is the, like I you know, what I said was, this is the control. This is where you're at right now, which is you're trying to hold the mount. And what you're focusing on is going into combat-based mount whenever the person turns. And there's loads of space now. And now the person's getting the knee on the inside. So then I say, without showing them how to do it, control the direction of the head. And they go, okay, he's told me what to do, but I don't know how to do it. How can I do it? And you start trying to, and you start finding novel ways. And then the next one is, you're on the right track, but here's how I've been doing it after doing it for a year or so. And so you're building it slowly, but you're sort of, it's going in for them to express it from inside out.
Do you know what it mimics? And this is like, this is a really weird thing, but this, how you explained it, I can't remember the exact, and something, author, you know, the big thing for like, novelists is to eventually write a book on how to write a novel.
Yeah.
Like that becomes, I think it's the ultimate expression, because you're saying like, thank you for appreciating my work. Here's how I did it.
Yeah.
You know, here's the secrets of some sort. Bird by Bird was the book, I think. And what she talked about, her simple concept that she wrote, all of these extremely complex narratives, sounds a lot like what you just described, which so many people, I think, are subconsciously or consciously trying to prove their worth in what they're doing,
yeah,
that they lose the actual worth of what they're doing. And what she was saying is like, writers specifically, they really try, and I'm so guilty of this, it's ridiculous. It's like, look how much I know. Let me show you how much I know, and here's how much I know. And by the time you get to the like middle of the paragraph, you want to vomit because it's just pretension.
Yeah.
And instead, she said, you know, the really like, people want to feel clever, right? They want to feel like they figured out something. The real trick with that is that if they feel like they figured something out, it will concretize in their mind because they are the discoverer. Like their ego kind of like cements that fact, which who cares about the ego in that regard, because it just made that lesson or that person stick to a concept that they can remember. They just learned, right? Mm-hmm. Is essentially what you're saying. And before you got to your last part, we're attacking the arm on the top mount arm bar. I was putting it behind me and I was pinning this way, and I looked at the other arm and I was like, oh, there's an Americana there, or the Kimura, or whatever. I think it was the top arm. So it'd be like, I think it would be Kimura. And so I was like, oh, I like that better. And I was like, I'm not going to say anything. And then you said it and I was like, I figured it out. Yeah. And it's mean as like, I'll never forget that move, only because you gave me you set the environment as a way for me to think that I was clever, even though you basically built the house that I was standing on. You let me put like a brick in it or my handprint. And I'm like, look at what I've done with this place. Yeah. And that is a trick of like a very good teacher. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're conscious of that is impressive, because I don't think a lot of people are. The only other person that I've heard this from, Dan John, you know, Dan John,
of course,
lives in Salt Lake. He's a great guy. Originally, learned a lot from him. Just like weird wisdom, not even from working out. Yeah. I could care less of what he does working out. Yeah. Like, yeah, he drags a sled up and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he's the originator of CrossFit, whatever he wants to, spout about. But he was explaining, you know, the clean is I think it's more complex than snatch. Snatch is easy. There's just like one starting point. There's no turnaround other than the top. It's super simple movement, because you either do it or you don't, and the bar falls out. The clean, though, man, you can jumble fuck that thing up and think that you did it, but it's the ugliest thing you've ever seen. So he's talking about pulling some of the complexity out of it. And so he's telling his kid, he'll teach basically his kids in high school how to power clean. And he's like, I do not teach them how to like drop down and receive it into a full clean, although that's an asinine term for most people, I get it. But in this case, you got to kind of separate the two. So power clean, full clean. Mm-hmm. And what he'll eventually notice is he'll try to get him to go heavier, heavier, heavier. Eventually the student will like receive it lower and lower and lower. Eventually, hey coach, I think if you just like catch it in the bottom and stand it up, like it's easier. And he's like, oh, weird. Like, I've never heard of that. And then he just lets them think that they figured out this really clever method until eventually they're like, oh, that's actually what the best people in the world do. You're like, cool, I'm on the right track. But because it solidifies in your mind, A, you're not messing with the movement pattern, which is CrossFit-esque is what they've done, you know, light weights, full clean, doesn't make any sense. And you've just let that person make such a tiny win that they're kind of connected to the sport, and I think there's reciprocation there eventually in teaching.
Yeah, 100%. And what that comes down to, and you're spot on. If you give someone something, they don't feel like they've earned it. And if they don't feel like they earned it, they don't value it. And what it really comes down to is emotional investment in what they're doing. If I show you a technique, there's really no emotional investment in that for you. And that's why a lot of people don't remember techniques. But if I can create a scenario where you work it out yourself, what's better than figuring something out? What's better than trying something that is a novel idea for you and then going, oh shit, this works. You remember that because it makes you happy. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel proud of yourself. So there's a big difference between, it's like, you're struggling for cash. I could give you $100. You're going to feel pretty shitty about it. You're probably going to want to forget about that. But if I say, you want to come help me do some work, you're going to go, okay, yeah, I'm earning this money, and you're going to feel good about it. And I think that works for learning anything. There's got to be some emotional investment, and you've got to feel like you got that yourself. You don't want to be handed it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The easiest way to fail I think in any profession is to do work for free. I could go out there today, and we've done some stuff, like a train on some big projects, and we've trained for a long time. I think that I know what I'm doing. If I offered for whatever reason to try to drum up more business, not that I would want to do that, Groupon or Kuba, and I put it in that, hey, I'll 10 people free. I just want to get my gym busy or whatever. Like, first 10 people are free. None of those 10 people in the first place, none of them will do what you tell them to do. Right? That I could be the best trainer, coach, jiu-jitsu practitioner in the world, but if I do it for free, there's no buy-in. Yeah, there's literally nothing solidifying the fact that that person is exchanging value other than just their time in your space. That is unbelievable. But on that same note, do you think that's why, like, experiences like this, where people travel from all around the world, yep, to do a big endeavor, they've invested heavily, yep, and therefore they're listening, they're open.
Yep, 100%. When you come to these camps, it's this kind of messed up thing, because I love teaching jiu-jitsu, and I would absolutely do it for free. You catch me, and you ask me a question, I'm going to give you the answer. But it's one of these funny things where the more you pay for a product, even if it's the same product, can affect how effective the product is. Mm-hmm. Which is an absolutely bizarre idea, you know, which is, you do a private lesson. If you were to do a private lesson with me for $20, and then you were to do the exact same lesson for $200, you're going to get more out of it.
Way more.
Which is, even it's the exact same product. So it's almost this idea is like, do I charge 10 times more? You know, someone goes, this guy's ripping me off. No, he's trying to make it the most effective thing for you. And there is a semblance of truth to that, which is kind of crazy. But and that's just because we use money. When we talk about investment, you can invest anything. Mm-hmm. You can invest time, you can invest emotion, you can invest effort, you can invest money, of course. But money is like the really easy one to do, because it's kind of it's the currency of the world. But yeah, anything you do, the more you put into it, the more you're going to get out of it. That is the reality. And something like this, where it's the big three. You're investing money, time, and effort to travel in. Yeah. People, the further you travel, the more engaged you're going to be, the more you'll want to take out of it, the harder you're going to work. You're not going to, you know, no one at this camp, I imagine, is sitting in bed at 11 o'clock scrolling through Instagram.
Yeah.
Because they're here, they've paid the money, they've traveled across the world, the instructors are here, they're getting out there, they're sunrise yoga, straight the jiu-jitsu, it's sauna for half an hour, grab a quick bit of food, back to open mat, you know, and it's like that all day.
And it's kind of interesting. So the first thing I thought was like, I'm not like a 6 a.m. do jujitsu kind of person. It's not my speed. Here, though, I'm like, well, the value that people brought, man, I don't want to miss out on that. I want to partake as much as possible because the investment is there. And even if the money thing goes away, it's the time, energy kind of deal. I'm here. It's temporary. Therefore, I got to take advantage of it. I also would... It's one of the reasons why we travel a lot. And you mentioned going to Athens. We went to Athens last year too, and then to Crete. It sounds really weird, but I was reading a couple books, and they all happened to reference Crete and the kind of birthplace of Western civilization. And I was like, oh man, I probably should go like see that. And then, you know, we're looking for places to go, I don't know, just explore. So we looked at that and I was like, oh, let's just go there. And you're right, like imagining you standing in front of the coffin tomb and seeing that depicted, like you've seen that for free all over the internet. Like I could look up anything that's at any museum, there's a picture of it somewhere, an archive, and I could look at it. But when you're standing in front of it, jet lagged, and you're going, now it means something to me. I think that is something different where you start to recognize things of value. And I fought with this idea for a long time because in my own practice, I think, man, I can learn faster. I can do it better. I can do, you know, I don't want to just hang out and go on the traditional thing. But I think there's something really important in jiu-jitsu where it's delayed hierarchy, right? Which is something that I really hated originally, which is like, oh, shut up. Like, I get it. It takes 10 years to get a black belt or whatever. And now it's something that I think is a feature of kind of like, getting rid of the vacationers of jiu-jitsu and saying, no, if you want to be serious about this, it takes 10 years to even get to a base level of learning. And then you can kind of start the process. Yeah. Is that something that you recognize like early on, or is that something that...
Yeah, I mean, the fact that jiu-jitsu is unique, very unique in its sense of how long it takes to get belts. And I mean, it's possibly the most defining feature of jiu-jitsu. It's what separates it from every other martial art. Like, you can get a black belt in judo in years if you're good, you know? But even if you're, I mean, we have ADCC medalists that aren't black belts, you know? We have, you really do. World-class grapplers, truly world-class grapplers that are purple. I mean, Nicky Roberts, blue belt for a ridiculous, a different ridiculous point, but, you know, blues, purples and browns. And you do wonder whether the reason for that is because it's so new. You already see, I spoke about this because my podcast covers a lot of UK grappling, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu history. And over the time that I've been doing it, the number of black belts has just exploded exponentially in the country. And obviously, the more black belts there are, I mean, it's going to be natural entropy in terms of the quality of black belts. Like, first black belt is going to be the gold standard, and second one's a little bit, you know, a little bit worse, and then the third one's a little bit more, and then it kind of spreads out. So you have, 20 years later, you have black belts that are way better and black belts that are way worse. And then, so you do wonder, in 50 years' time, are people going to be getting black belts in like 4 or 5 years? You know, like,
is it strip mall karate?
Are you going to be able to do that? And I hope not, because I do feel like the difficulty to get belts is functionally part of the sport. Like, it's built into the culture, and I hope that it stays that way, because it, the harder it is to get something, the more valuable that thing is. You know, I'd be lying if I told you, and this sounds weird maybe, but I'd be lying if I told you that my black belt felt less valuable when I started to see people who I didn't feel like that level get black belts. You know, when I got it, it was, you know, or maybe even when I was working towards it, it was a really, really big prize. And as I came closer towards it, it came closer towards me, and we met in the middle, because other people who I thought, oh, I beat that guy, I'm better than that guy. You know, that guy, yeah, he's been training a while, but he doesn't give a shit, really. So it devalues it slightly. And so I hope it continues to be at roughly the level that it is, because it gives value to the person who gets there. And I think also I like how long it takes to get there, because it forces people to, I mean, it doesn't force people, but it encourages people to not be focused on arbitrary things like the belts. Because people, I mean, I was chatting to someone about this on the first day we were here, actually, who, you know, people struggle after a couple of years of training to, after the honeymoon period is gone, to really settle into, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life or as long as I physically can. And there has to be a shift from a, if you have a quantifiable goal for your progress through jiu-jitsu, such as blue belt, purple belt, brown belt, black belt, you have a real problem. You're looking at the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
Just a color of a piece of cloth that puts your gi together. And instead look at something such as, you know, the goal for you when you do jiu-jitsu should only be the attainment of mastery. It's the only thing that matters. Because if you only care about getting your blue belt, what happens when you do? If you only care about getting your black belt, what happens when you do?
Yeah,
you know, but if you only care about mastery, which is impossible, you can only reach towards it. You'll never quite get it.
It's an infinite game.
It's infinite. Yeah. You're always chasing after that. So the fact that it's going to be 10 years, if a black belt took 4 years, you'd have a hard time convincing anyone to focus on mastery. That's for sure.
It's a really good point. It's something that, like, even though I find that I can figure things out pretty easily, that probably took me up until very recently to understand the value of the time delay. Because I wasn't aiming for that consciously. You know, I have a very abstract goal with jiu-jitsu, which is I want this experiential creativity. I just want to be able to experience creativity in that moment or something. It's very abstract. It's like there's this moment that happens, flowy jiu-jitsu, whatever you want to call it, where you can create something temporary. It's almost like it's a jam session to me, right? When you learn music, you're like you're practicing technically and you're doing like all of this really boring work that is not fulfilling to get to the point where you and a friend can pick up and riff off of each other and do something that no one else will ever experience. It's a very private, intimate experience between two people, essentially. And that's my whole hope and desire for jiu-jitsu. And a lot of the times I was like, that's too esoteric. That's like, there's no way to measure that. There's no way to work towards it. Other than the only reason I show up to learn jiu-jitsu is like, okay, if I understand this concept and I can keep the game going or whatever. But it re-solidified in my mind once I understood that value of whatever the level, doesn't even, the ranking level is kind of unimportant. It's just like, as soon as you can get rid of it, now you've learned the lesson, which I think the distance teaches. Mm. It's the same thing in endurance sports. Like a lot of people are trying to push, go further, further, further. And it's something that you recognize when you've done those kinds of efforts is that there's a time when you're done with it. When you're like, I've figured out how to take care of myself through the hardest conditions. I don't need to do it anymore. I've had like that experience. And you can then partake in the micro doses of those experiences and get the same thing out of it. Like, I don't need so much. When Socrates talks about, you know, Plato originally talked about this word pharmakon. The reference to it is really weird, but it goes back to essentially the Eleusinian mysteries. And they're talking about some form of magical dosage of some kind of plant extract that gave people visions and had ecstatic experiences. And he talked about pharmakon being the first word that had two meanings. It meant poison and the cure. It meant both. And there's something in between there that you referenced where you're like, you know, the value and the devalue, and you really want to be on top of that bell curve, right? And that's the hardest thing to balance, because you're right. You want jiu-jitsu to grow. You want more people to experience this thing, because inherently that, the more data, the more input you get into jiu-jitsu from as many different creative minds, it's this hive mind. It becomes this thing that you can't even imagine it becoming, but it also devalues it because it homogenizes it and it spreads it so thin. Because it becomes a commodity, and things that commodify tend to devalue. Like any, you can look at any product, I mean, the cameras to all of this shit gets made super cheap now. It's like, I've got like 8K camera. I've got 10 of them or whatever. And you're like, that would have cost $50,000 10 years ago to have like a, you know, that kind of definition in a camera. It's been so commodified that now I don't even care, right? Like I have a phone that does that or whatever. And so you're right that the value is so hard to recognize because we're so, maybe it's our commerce mind. We're always trying to like find it cheaper, do it faster, do all this thing. And jujitsu and physical practices kind of lay outside of that value system, which I think is really interesting. It's something that nobody really wants to talk about in the industry because people, A, they like doing jujitsu, they like doing fitness stuff, but they also want to make money doing it because they want to be rewarded for their value. So it's this very difficult balance. You good on time?
Yeah, we're just
in an hour, so I wanted to go into one more thing and then...
Yeah, sweet. As long as you want, mate.
Yeah. I was loving the... Did you go to the gong bath?
I haven't, no.
Have you ever done a gong bath?
Yeah, I did the first year here. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was good.
Yeah.
You do it?
We do sound baths.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so like I play didgeridoo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we do. I play a lot of drums.
No way, nice.
Yeah, to talk about like, I mean, we can get into it. It's one of the things that opened up about going back through history and looking at traditional things. Because I was fairly like, fuck tradition. I'm going to like, you know, new stuff is cooler. And I just started going back through philosophy and other things and found music through that. And then something happened to me when I started playing drums that just like, I don't know what it was, but something really strange.
Drums like a vehicle that travel through the spirit realm.
Yeah. And then you learn that after, like, I was just like, oh, I like drumming. And it was like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I like was dreaming about it. It felt like, and then all sorts of weird, this gets super weird, but
you play traditional drum?
Yeah, djembe, frame drum. I'll play whatever. Anything that kind of hang pan, all that stuff is just interesting to me. I prefer a djembe.
Yeah.
Super simple, but infinite technique.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so you have like bass, tone, slap, and then from that, you can make really any combination.
Yeah.
You can make any kind of music.
Yeah.
Anyway, the music thing brought me... just a really weird way back into the like physical traditions. Mm-hmm. Like what were they good for?
Yeah.
This physical practice, this is something that I've been trying to come back to, something that I mentioned earlier. I had a friend who wanted us to do a symposium for jujitsu specific stuff. And my first thing was like, I can't do it. Not because I'm incapable, but because I think how we look at things is very much from a conceptual, principle, intellectual side of things. And I think jujitsu has already found its way to feel. And we're trying to take intellectualism conceptually, give it to somebody, logical constructs on how the body works, physiology, all the basic stuff, and then trying to teach them to turn that off so that they can feel it as a nervous system. Right? Forget about all the logic. Just feel what the effort feels like. Yeah. You don't need a heart rate monitor. You don't need a power meter, ergometer, any of that stuff. You need to feel what effort feels like so you can make the decision to continue going, all of that stuff. And when it comes to jujitsu, I think it's already pointed that direction. I think people are already the best are very sensitive. So the work that I think is probably, if I was going to guess, and I'm probably not qualified to even say it, but if I could imagine what I could add to jujitsu is like bringing concepts and principles to it, more conceptual framework, more intellectualism to it what I get from it in exchange is the feeling emotional quality of the exchange.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a long rant into my personal practice. But I do want to, we were talking about, where did we leave off before they came in?
Eleusis.
Oh, yeah. So they wanted to set up the symposium. I told them I'd have to, it's been 3 years now that I've been thinking about how to do it.
Yeah.
Who to involve, like who would it be? Anyway, so we've been looking at this like hypothetical event or something like that.
Yeah.
And I have a couple people in mind, but it's interesting because I heard you talk and I go, okay, you're somebody who like I see is thinking about this stuff differently.
Yeah.
And so maybe in a couple of years, I'll probably I'll pitch you on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Why not?
I want to get to one one last topic.
Yeah.
For you, how did you get into strength training?
Yeah.
I think it's probably pretty obvious, but also what brought you to the specialties that you're into?
Yeah, strength training is an interesting one. I think it's funny because culturally in jiu-jitsu, there isn't a strong tie between strength and conditioning and doing jiu-jitsu. And it makes sense because, well, it can make sense when you understand. But jiu-jitsu is one of the most successful marketing campaigns that's ever existed in sport. Because these guys in Brazil adapted Japanese jiu-jitsu, Japanese judo, and it kind of created a unique style that was really effective and a bit novel in the world, and then marketed it incredibly, you know, from UFC 1 to challenge matches to whatever else. And the whole marketing slogan was the little guy can beat the big guy. So when you have that as your main hook, you can't, your jiu-jitsu class can't come with a weightlifting book as well, because it goes against the whole philosophy of what they're selling. The reality is that whilst there is a lot of truth to the small guy can beat the big guy, it's still a sport, and in any physical endeavor, strength is never a weakness. So when you look at all the other forms of grappling, be it judo, be it wrestling, be it catch as catch can, and we can get in specifically the catch stuff. But when you look at all the other forms of wrestling, because they're not on a marketing campaign, they can just be real. Mm-hmm. And they all have really deep cultural ties to strength and conditioning work. Mm-hmm. And all martial arts do. And the longer they go back, the longer, be it going back to wrestlers in Iran and India with garters and mules and stuff like that, and clubs and maces. So yeah, it's just an interesting thing. It's like with jiu-jitsu, it's almost weird to be really connected with strength training stuff because of this marketing campaign from the Gracies in the 90s. But the reality is that they're super closely linked. Now, how I got into strength training was that I was a very small, weak kid. So when I started jiu-jitsu, I was 50 kilos, which is 110 pounds. I was 14 years old. I was not, I never played any sports as a kid, really. I was just not very good at them. And I got into jiu-jitsu and around about the age of 16 or so, after I was a tiny kid in adult classes getting my ass kicked, just because sometimes they were better, but sometimes they were worse. And there is actually nothing more annoying in jiu-jitsu, especially after the marketing idea of small guy beats the big guy if the technique's better. I know my technique is better, but I'm being squashed. So I had this thing, and it's very possible that my love of strength training comes from the fact that I was a small, weak kid being beaten up by these adults who are bigger than me. And it's kind of just really driven into my deep subconsciousness, you know, almost like a childhood trauma. You know, that I want to be bigger and stronger. And so I got into strength training through reading Dinosaur Training by Brooks Kubik. To me, it's still the Bible. Is the Bible of strength training. Yeah. That I had exposure to that about 16, and that started the journey. And what I liked about Dinosaur Training, have you read it?
I haven't, actually.
Yeah, amazing. And it resonated with me on every single level, the way that he was writing and what he was talking about. And the dinosaurs that he's referring to in Dinosaur Training is the old school strongmen, George Hackenschmidt and Eugene Sandows and Arthur Saxons and stuff like that. And these guys were all wrestlers.
You know,
it was super tied in. This wrestling and strength. The old time strongman, the golden age of old time strongman and performing strongman, they would do feats of strength and they would wrestle. And as a grappler, and it was a lot about strong neck and strong trunk and strong forearms and hands and grip training. And it just hit a chord with me, really did. And a lot of thick bar training. So I buy a 2.5 inch non-revolving sleeve, no knurled barbell.
just a fucking bar and like 90 kilos of weights. And I start doing just, you know, floor prep, didn't have a, had nothing apart from a bar. Floor press, I didn't have a bench. Deadlifts, I couldn't squat, didn't have a rack. And bicep curls and overhead press, military press. And I just started doing this. And then eventually I started to add a few more things to the collection. I put some hooks into the ceiling so I could do some pull-ups. Got some farmer's walk bars so I could cut, so I could walk with them. And that's how my strength training journey really started. And it's just kind of continued on from there. And the grip thing in particular, which is kind of what I'm most known for, is it's like the most obvious thing. Because you do jiu-jitsu. You do jiu-jitsu and you go, the one thing I could really do with here is get being able to control that, whether it's gi in the lapel or sleeve or wrist or whatever, is being able to control that. And this idea that in jiu-jitsu, and sort of grip almost isn't even the hat. Well, it's not just the hands, but grip is really, you can grip with your feet.
Yeah.
You know, you can grip with, you know, it's your ability to connect with something and pull it towards you is really what gripping is. So whether it's the fingertips or the hand or a hook in position or a cup in position or the whole arm here, and it's really essential for jiu-jitsu. So that's how I got in the grip and I started training with that. And then I saw the effects that it was having really quickly on my game. And I was like, this is fucking awesome. And it was just
that.
I really
quickly want to make just a metaphorical observation
yeah.
that I have never thought about until you mentioned that in my experience, people who train grip, climbers, jiu-jitsu people, strongmen, even grip competitors for World's Strongest Grip, these kind of guys, they are generally very sweet and warm. And they're very embracing, right? They're bringing the world to you. And the power lifters that I know who have weak fucking hands, who are always like just pushing things away, also are isolating themselves, listening to death metal. And there's like an emotional, it just in my head popped up that there is something very metaphorical about you bringing the world to you and you pushing the world away. I'm just going to leave it there. I'll let other people I'll get fucking emails from people bitching about me saying the bench pressing is pushing the world away.
yeah. Or the bench presses are assholes or something.
Yeah. You have a great collection. Your garage, if people don't know, we'll point them towards so people can see your collection, which is very rare. Where do you live in the UK?
I'm in North London.
Oh, okay. So like it's already real estate is a premium. So it's crazy that you have a training room that
it's not big. That's the one thing that people say is it's just in my garage and it's not big. And the first thing people, when they come around, I thought it was bigger. I talk to what people say when they see me for the first time. I thought you were taller. It must be the fisheye lens in the gym making me in the gym look big. But it's funny because it's where everything started. I had nothing. I had no equipment to begin with. And I just built it. I do have a quirk of my personality. I'm a collector. I am a collector. Whatever I do, I collect. I like things. Be it books or be it equipment or anything, if I have an interest in something, I'll buy an unnecessary amount of
things. Is this why you're not into the gi as much? Is because you just
have a million gis. I would have a million gis.
I do. It sucks.
That's not the reason. It wasn't because I get gis for free, I don't have to actually buy them. But I do collect things. So yeah, the gym is like my baby, really. I'm incredibly proud of it. And I do, people say, you know, this is heaven. And I feel like that every single time I walk in there. You know, I go there, I'm in there every day. Either training or I'm cleaning or I'm sorting something, I'm doing something, but I'm in there almost every single day of my life. And every single time I walk in, I'm like, yeah, this fucking rocks.
I brought it up originally. Not knowing this is how you felt about your garage. And we said we'd come back to it if you remembered. You building an environment, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We'll probably forget about it.
No, it's good, right?
Building an environment is such an interesting thing. I mean, I'm really interested in psychology and, you know, the way that the brain can affect the body and even down to stuff like
like other questions that I've had on a similar sort of vein, like why'd you work out in jeans, you know, stuff like that, and the idea of like enclosed cognition, you know enclosed cognition, yeah. You know, what you wear affects how you feel about yourself and how you express yourself and changes your personality and changes your mood, and so does the environment that you're in, and places can. And maybe you're getting into a more of the spiritual realm here, but places can be of power, right?
Yeah.
And you can create an environment that, and whether that's a real thing, whether the spirits are lifting you when you're in a room that has power, or whether it's just you feel that and therefore you're able to express that. But I mean, I had a guy come and train with me recently. He was a calisthenics guy, big dude, very strong. And he's been working on a one-arm pull-up for 10 years, never hit it. Mm. He walked into the gym, he put his hand on a pull-up bar and he did a one-arm pull-up. And he went, what the fuck? Never done it in my life, first time ever. It's the cave. That's the power that it has, you know? And it is like that. And I think you can do that. And environment, you know, when you talk about environment, what does that mean? It's like the physical space. It can be what it is. What's the vibe you're getting from it? And then, of course, it's also the people inside of that space. And that's a whole other topic of, you know, which can have much more effect. You can have a really awesome room with a bunch of assholes in here, or closed-minded and bitchy and clicky and all of that stuff. And you're not going to have a good place. So building the environment is sort of the foundation of what you want to have in there. It's the first stake in the ground of what you're trying to achieve, irrespective of anything. So yeah, environment is important.
I'm kind of blown away. I watch your videos. Like at first I was just like, oh cool, some grip stuff, like who cares, like. And, but it was good because you were hitting some topics that I don't think people talk about. The grip is very specific. It's not just measurable about the crushing or isometric or any of these things, but also that you have to counterbalance it, right? That it is not just about the, you know, the closure, but it's about the extension, and it's about, you know, all the things that are down the chain. And in doing so, you solved a lot of elbow problems for people. I think that's still people consistently, that is the number one thing that I hear about, is elbow issues.
That's why so many of my videos are talking about.
Yeah,
Because it's so, it's sort of one of these things, it's so funny, I've put out so much content that talks about medial epicondylitis, you know, the pain on the inside of the elbow caused from grappling a lot of the time for a lot of the people who follow me. And I'm putting out so many videos and I still get the question. There's always like, the problem with Instagram, there's no search function on there. You can't go down, you know, you can't, it's hard to find old videos and stuff like that. But, so I should probably just stop putting them on YouTube or something.
Just repost them.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of ends up happening then a little bit, but I make different videos and about different things. But the idea is a lot more, you know, what you're talking about here is basically in jiu-jitsu, we're squeezing all the time, but it can be the same for powerlifters or anyone doing anything. We are very, you know, flexion in the hand. We're closing our hand and we're crushing, we're gripping all the time. And you build up an imbalance in your flexors and extensors, and then you get elbow pain. Yeah. And the problem that people have is people don't understand how connected the whole body is. So they feel pain in the elbow and they think they've hurt their elbow. They feel pain in the wrist, they think they've hurt their wrist. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they feel pain in the knee, they think they've hurt their knee. And sometimes they have. But you would be surprised how often that is not the case. I get pain in my wrist when I have tightness in my extensor. I have it at the moment on this arm. And if I have a little bit more time, or if I find like a nice, there might be one over here actually. You know, but when this really became apparent to me was during COVID, the wrist thing especially, because you do jiu-jitsu, you fall on your wrist, you base out, you feel your wrist get hurt and you go, my wrist is hurt, and it hurts for a month and then it slowly recovers. Mm. And I was training, I was during COVID when I wasn't training jiu-jitsu at all, I was just lifting, and one day I wake up and my wrist hurts. And if I was training jiu-jitsu, I would go, oh, maybe I fell on it funny yesterday. But it wasn't. There was absolutely no reason that I hurt my wrist. But I'd been training, I'd been lifting. And I'd caused some tightness in the forearm, so I get in there, I find the area, I massage it out, 5 minutes, I let go, my wrist is fine. Because a small injury, and even if you fall on your wrist and it feels like your wrist hurts, sometimes an injury can happen higher up along the forearm, along the extensor, and you're positive, no, it cannot be anything else. It hurts in my wrist. No, that tightness in the forearm is pulling up all the connective tissue, all the muscle, and it's feeling like your wrist is tight. You smash that out and then the wrist pain goes. And it's stuff like that that people don't understand. But talking about, you know, training the opposing, the antagonist muscles and muscle groups to remedy injuries, this is not just true of the grip, but it's true of the whole body, everything, right? Yeah. So people have a really bad habit of, in training for their sport, they identify the movement patterns from the sport, and then they go to the gym and they get stronger in them. So if you are pull on the mat, you go to the gym to do pull to get stronger at doing pull on the mat. You go to the gym, you do it more. Now, when you're training all of that pulling on the mats, you are creating a muscular imbalance. Yeah. Then you go to the gym and you double down on that muscular imbalance. Now, that isn't to say that you can't go to the gym and pull. It means that you go to the gym, you pull, and you push as well. And you balance that out. And that's what the training outside, the only training that the number one priority of physical training outside of your sport should be to reduce the injury chance. And the second priority after that is to improve performance. Because as George Hackensmith says, one of my favorite quotes, there is no strength without health. Right. Or health and strength cannot be devoid of each other. And in order to be strong, you must be healthy. And that's not true. That's true in a sort of broader, more long-term perspective. Sometimes people can sacrifice health for performance and they can achieve things, but they're going to pay for it in the future. And then you have to ask the question, because most people who are listening, most people who I'm going to be teaching, most people follow my Instagram, I'm not giving advice, even though a lot of the advice that I give is going to be useful for super high level athletes. That's not the main, when I teach seminars, I'm not teaching seminars to black belt world champions, even though I'm sure that maybe there's some stuff in there that could help them. Teaching it to white belts, blue belts, purple belts, brown belts, black belts, hobbyists, you know, who really just want to be, maybe even if they don't know yet, but their goal should be to train for as long as they can and feel good in their body doing so.
I think people lose the timeline a lot of the times. Going back in our history with strength training and where we've derived it from, a lot of people don't understand where it comes from and what it said originally. We've pulled things out that get missed. And this is one of the things that we've even acknowledged that we've gone over. Oliver Kochansky's stuff, the original Soviet data, all of that stuff it's prime with data that we probably should have recognized the importance of. And we've kind of missed it sometimes. And what we extrapolate from it is you should bench, dead, and squat, right? And then you should do 3 sets of 10 for hypertrophy and 5 sets of 2 for strength. And it should be part of your 1 rep max. And it's become very reductionist. And that's not what strength training to me is looking at what the weakness is, right? And a lot of people, they just, you could take it to jujitsu perfectly, how it's a pulling sport, so I need to go chins. And then it gets even worse. They wrap their gi around and they do pull-ups and they pretend that you're pulling all day. And the same thing is true, not of just of strength training, but of the energy system that goes into it. So you see the same thing with MMA fighters where you go, you know, oh, you have 5-minute rounds. So they come into the gym and they do 5-minute, you know, interval sessions. And you're like, I get it. It makes sense to you, but strength and conditioning is complementary. That does not mean that it goes with. It actually means that it goes against. So it looks at what is happening in the sport and it counterbalances it. So you're doing a lot of 5-minute intervals. You should probably be doing a lot of longer zone 2 aerobic work to support that. You're doing a lot of pulling. You should probably balance it with some pushing or some kind of overhead work just to get out of your kyphotic state.
Yeah, it's like a complimentary dish in a restaurant isn't the same dish.
Exactly. This is what steakhouses get wrong all the time. They serve you a fucking Wagyu ribeye, and it's like the fattiest, best thing. And then they serve it with truffle mac and cheese. Yeah. You're like, no, that tastes terrible. It needs an acid.
That sounds pretty good. But
it does.
So yeah, you're right.
But
yeah,
it needs an acid to cut that you can actually appreciate the flavor. Yeah. And this would be the same thing. Like if I develop my shoulder capacity to articulate in the range of motion that I don't see normally, this range of motion actually gets stronger. Yeah. And this is part of the hard. It's the hard part, because again, strength trainers and people have been thought of culturally as being dumb. Mm. And therefore, it makes sense to me that when people do strength training, they are dumb. Mm. Because culturally, we don't appreciate the intelligence that it takes to look at a system, see where it's weak, and fix that problem. Yeah. And that's how we've always described strength training to us, is like, find the problem, fix the problem. Mm. You know, if and it's hard to do. It's not like, yeah. It's not super simple, because it, from climbing and jiu-jitsu, originally Mark, when he was working with jiu-jitsu guys, the only reason he was able to do it was because he recognized the problems were very similar to another sport that pulled in the same direction, ice climbing and, you know, rock climbing. So he was able to go, I think you guys need to do this. And it helped quite a bit for performance. But then other mistakes were made because we are human and we, you know, and it takes us a long time to learn. I only now start to understand how to complement jiu-jitsu training. Even though I've been, you know, strength training and different modality training for, you know, 15, 20 years, it's just now that I'm like, oh, this is actually what would complement Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Sadly, it's happening on the cusp where Jiu-Jitsu is becoming very prominent, and therefore strength and conditioning coaches from all walks are starting to apply principles to it. And although they're probably good principles, Jiu-Jitsu is not football. Jiu-Jitsu isn't track and field. It's not one of these sports. It needs its own strength application. So I do really appreciate your approach to it, because I think out of the people that I see, yours is probably one of the only intelligent approaches to strength training. And I think I think it's good because it's very different. The clubs, the bells, all of the old-timey strength stuff. Mm. I mean, Steinborns, all of these weird lifts that people kind of write off as, you know, circus acts. You're like, there's a reason why they were culturally accepted as being a feature of being strong.
Yeah.
And now you can see it. Like, before we had any data, right, the grip was like such a sign that you were withering away.
Yes.
And now we, you know, Peter Attia talks about it all the time. You're like, your grip is like your ability to get off the ground, i.e. a Turkish get up, your ability to hold on to something, maximal grip, are the biggest predictors of longevity. Mm. Between those two, you have everything. And I think with what you describe and what you do, these are actually what you're talking about. Mm. And strength isn't so much about a 1,000-pound back squat as it is about being able to move your body in time and space for as long as possible.
That's 100% it. And I mean, jiu-jitsu is interesting because, sort of, unlike many other sports, you can have so many different styles. So you almost have to cater it to the individual as well, because there are some guys who are crazy explosive, and there are some guys that use crazy amounts of isometric. They're slow and they're methodical, and you almost have to cater to those individuals a little bit as well. But in terms of like the clubs and the other stuff. I mean, as much as I'd love to take credit for it, all I do is look at the old times, you know? Yeah. What have wrestlers been doing in Iran and India for 1,000 years? What were old-time strongmen doing back 100 years ago? And why aren't we doing it now? You know, and I think we have such influence from, you know, there is a bit of a renaissance, or maybe it feels like that because I'm inside of it, you know?
Yeah.
But who knows? But I feel like, you know, when I post videos, the most interesting comment that I get on so many is, what muscles does this work? You know? What's it do? And I go, you're coming from it's a very bodybuilding centric, because I come from, and I only really have interest in performance-based goals. You know, even though, look, if you are super strong and your diet's in check, you'd look good, you know, but that's not the goal. That's the byproduct. But 95% of people who do strength training, the strength is a byproduct and the aesthetics is the primary. So many people come and they look at, what muscle does that work? What does that achieve? Is that going to make your bicep bigger? I go, it's not about making my bicep bigger. It's about being stronger in a position that I'm going to have to use on the mat, or stuff like that. So yeah, the question of what muscle is that working is always a good one. Or I'm swinging clubs and, you know, I'm getting articulation through the shoulder and all of these different ranges and the grips working and all of this stuff. And this is stuff that wrestlers have done for 1,000 years, and goes, What muscles does it work on, bro? You don't get
not,
it, bro.
Not the one up
you
here.
You don't get it, bro. You don't get it. Yeah.
I think that's something we've got a lot, just because of the. No matter how much real work you do, people will remember the cultural stuff. So it's the 300. It's the Superman stuff. Yeah. And to be honest, when we approached those jobs, we wanted the, even though the goal, the primary goal is an aesthetic.
Yeah.
We did it through. We did it as a side effect, right?
But that's because the primary goal is not aesthetic, because you're not trying to make them look big. You're trying to make them look strong, right?
I would say, yeah. And I want them to feel capable, so they don't have to act.
But like Superman is not big because he's a Mr. Olympian.
Right.
It's because he's can lift a fucking mountain, right? And the 300, they want to look like that they are the only full-time warriors in all of the Greek region,
right?
You know, so even though and obviously the Greeks, the Spartans did not look like that.
No.
So it, you know, you've got to do it through the filter of Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they've got to be bigger, and they've got to be jacked, and they've got to be shredded in a completely unrealistic way.
Yeah.
But ultimately they have to look capable.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes people don't really care if they look capable, if the biceps are big, if, you know, it's like big biceps, big shoulders, big chest, skinny legs sort
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. So like, even though, so when you're training these guys, I imagine what you're going to say is you're starting all that basis with them being strong and capable.
Yeah.
But that's because you're looking not just to be as big as possible, but you're looking for a aesthetic that shows to the audience immediately capability.
Yeah, and there's no way to fake that, right? Like, and that's what we've always treated it like. So even at the fundamental, so capability for us is first about understanding what you can do, like where you're at. And it, a lot of the times it's just a deadlift number, or maybe it's just a aerobic thing that, you know, an arbitrary task that you need to accomplish. Mirror that against somebody who is capable. 300 FY is the one that comes to mind because we use that a lot, which is just like, you know, understanding there's something very good feeling in the world when I can lift a stone off the ground and I know that it weighs, you know, 250 pounds and I can put it up on a shelf. And, you know, what does that mean to anybody? Nothing, because in the real, there's a guy that can do a 500 pound stone or whatever. But what it means is when I interact in the world, I have a concept and an idea of how I can interact with the world. And I feel like if I interacted in the world and, you know, if something happened, I would probably be very capable at, if there was a physical requirement, I would be okay.
Yeah.
But no matter what the requirement, endurance, strength, or capacity, I would be able to offer something of value. And that value is a psychological point of reference that then is reflected in your posture and your aesthetic. You know, I'm always like, I'm a bit fat, or like, God, I've lost some tissue because I've been rolling too much and not lifting weights enough, or, you know, too much endurance work, too much running, not enough of this. There's always like the hypercritical me, but that hypercritical me that exists, hopefully exists in everybody. It just doesn't take control. It just gives me good feedback in order to constantly keep myself in check. Hey, I'm getting a little bit weak. I should probably start picking up some heavier things. Hey, you're getting a bit fat. I should probably lay off the croissants or whatever the thing is. And this thing keeps me in check because the overall appearance is the side effect of the root thing that we're all looking in each other is like, what can you do? Can we do that together? And now you have this tribe, this, you know, this bond with other people. In jiu-jitsu, I think it's kind of lazy, but you show up, you enjoy jiu-jitsu together, and you get to know them because you roll together. You do hard things, so those become your friends.
Yeah.
They're never tried necessarily outside of that, so it's kind of a hard mark of like true friendship, but it's a start. And strength training, like, I don't really have any friends that don't lift weights, do hard everything. And that's not to say... It's not on purpose.
Yeah.
It's just a feature of like, when people are like, I'm like, like, what are you against? Or when they don't, this is another weird one that comes up all the time, because people ask Aaron and I, like, well, how do you eat when you travel? Because when I go, everybody's drinking. And I was like, we don't hang out with people that act like that. because A, it's not, it doesn't add to my capability, right? I want people that are waking up and training. I want them talking about how to get stronger, what foods make them feel better. You know, even though we have some friends that get a bit weird and they're eating like, you know, raw lamb liver and shit.
Yeah.
I like that because I'm like, wait, what does it do to you? Like, should I try it? There's something about these, humans that want to get better that I want to be around because I want to get better. And that's the environment I'm always trying to foster.
Yeah.
And it seems like you've done such a phenomenal job. I want to be super mindful of your time. I don't want to take your whole day. Is there anything else you want to add to this? Or do you want to tell people where they can find you and where they can learn more about you?
Absolutely. You can find me on Instagram. It's probably the best place. My handle is @raspberry_ape. If you're interested in my podcast, it's called The Raspberry Ape Podcast. You can find it on all the places you find all your podcasts on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube. YouTube channel is basically, if you search for Raspberry Ape, you'll find me. And I've got a couple of courses online and they are at apeacademyonline.com. And grip training one, sandbag training, and the guillotine one as well. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you very much for having me. I feel like we could talk for
Ten hours. I'll bring a real kit and we'll have to do it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, man.
My absolute pleasure.
Thank you for the lesson.